WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
At the New Yorker Festival last month, Jerry Seinfeld and Steve Martin joined the New Yorker's Susan Morrison, and they talked about the art of creating those little explosive devices that we call jokes.
Now, I know that both of you feel very strongly about the technique and the craft of writing jokes. And I'd love to hear you describe, each of you, the process, your process for coming up with a bit, shaping it, refining it. You know, how long does the whole thing take? I mean, how does it start?
Well, that's an easy question.
That's so easy. I'll let you go first.
The thing I like about writing comedy or any kind of writing is there's no rhyme or reason to it. Nobody knows how to do it. Nobody has figured out anything. So everyone's free to do it. And I kind of like that complete chaos of the process of, especially jokes. I was talking to somebody today and the guy said, quick question. And I just said, what is a quick question? Why is it any different from any other question? Is it going to be less words? Does it mean my answer is short? It's just one of these annoying little things that people say. So I will write something like that down and see if it annoys other people the way it annoys me by talking about it in front of an audience. And if it does annoy them, I'll just play with it.
I found that performing live, it's just an ongoing exercise with a line. You trim it, you make it longer, you do a different setup, you knock out part of it, and you keep trying it night after night. I think Jerry writes more perfectly than I could. Like, honestly, I feel about Jerry's lines, you go, that's so beautifully cadenced.
And, but a lot of it, Steve, was done by the audience. Those are the final versions. Yep. My original notes bear, you know, not too much resemblance to the final product. I've been reading this history of the Marx Brothers, and they would tour for 5 weeks, four shows a day with a movie script.
Right.
Four shows a day. They'd pick out like six or seven scenes from the movie script and perform them over and over again to find out where the laughs were and to tighten it and shape it. And I've really become obsessed with them reading this book. Steve, did you ever meet any of the Marx Brothers?
I met Groucho. I was at an event. He was very old, very old. And a woman came up to him. I happened to be standing there. And she said, can I shake your hand? And he said, honey, you can shake anything you want.
So it sounds like what begins as a kind of a something loose and lumpy on a yellow legal pad then just gets honed and honed and honed by performing it live.
Absolutely true. I did stand up for 18 years and, you know, honed it and worked it. But I had really honed everything down so much I no longer had any material. I took 4 hours and whittled it down to an hour and then I just quit.
Right.
But I feel so much more at ease writing comedy now than I ever have in my life. It just seems to come easier. I can quickly write a, you know, a punchline to something way, way easier than I used to earlier in my life. And I read something, it was in Hungarian, and it was unpronounceable for me, but translated to a relaxed brain. And and it talked about people who are witty, they get a relaxed brain and their mind is more relaxed. And I realized I'm more relaxed because I've had a career and I'm not auditioning all the time. And it's enabled me to relax and feel very free.
Where do you think it would have gone? And I know how you feel about your the transition you made when you finished your stand-up work and moved into the movies. What if you had just not stopped? Because you would have had to transition from the this character into someone that was more yourself, so that you could be comfortable. And what if you had just kept going? Where do you think it would have led you?
I my mind was so dry. I think it would have been very hard to start up a whole new idea. And the idea of my act was so vivid that it would be very hard to change. But what actually happened is I took 30 years off and came back with Marty Short. And I have a new persona when I'm working with Marty Short, which is kind of a sort of distilled version of what I used to do. But I do have a new persona because of that.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, interesting. Well, so the title of the book, Jerry, is This Anything? And it's about the way comedians routinely, you know, in this honing process that we've talked about, they try out bits on each other and say, is this funny? Is this funny? And, you know, obviously that had to start somewhere in your lives. And I'm curious if either one of you can tell me the first time you met like another funny kid, you know, as a kid, who was the person who you were able to bounce things back and forth with, who you were able to crack up? Because it must, that must be a real moment if you're a funny kid to find somebody who can
Interesting that you would even ask that, because I don't know, for me, that was a gigantic, gigantic moment in my life when I met another funny kid, which was in third grade. I was so excited because you start laughing together in a way that you don't, you know, before that. Steve, do you remember meeting your first funny friend when you were a little kid?
Sure. Well, but I don't know if we were funny, but we laughed so much and so hard. Now, but I actually don't remember either one of us being funny, but we would, you know, engage in such a way or look around. I wanted to be a magician. And so I was 15 and I got a job at Disneyland's Magic Shop. And there was a guy there, I just saw him last year actually, named Jim Barlow. And he was a funny guy. And he would pitch magic tricks and he had all this patter. And it would just be for customers who had come up in the Fantasyland. And I was dying to do that. And I finally got the job. Somebody quit. And I got the job. I was 15. I couldn't believe it. And I just took, with his permission, I took all of Jim's patter. And eventually, I actually wrote every joke down on a 3x5 card. And there were 200 jokes. And I have it somewhere, all these little jokes. Like Jim would go up to a customer and say, may I take your money? I mean, help you?
So, Jerry, do you know what this your first funny friend is doing now?
He's in advertising. I feel like those friends, I mentioned three guys that I went to Queens College with in the introduction of the book who encouraged me. Mm-hmm. And I thought we were all the same. And they, one day they said to me, you know, you're funnier than us. And we had gone to some comedy club in the city and they told me that they thought I could do that. That was a gigantic encouragement to me that I still remember.
I mean, in the book, Jerry, you say that even today, when you're in the company of other stand-up comedians, you feel like you're rolling around in a litter of puppies. I mean, do you still feel that way? And
yes,
or are you just kind of home with the kids?
I'm sure, Steve, there's an energy around comedy people that is unlike any other social energy.
I like to be with comedians because I feel an empathy. I feel we've both done the same thing and we understand something.
Right. Steve, do you think that when you have a comedic perspective, you kind of think that the entire human experience is just kind of this silly charade and it's all funny to you? Everything is funny.
I've said this before, but when I was younger, I could be an iconoclast. Mm-hmm. And as I got older, I started to have empathy. And it's hard to tear down people and make fun of people because you kind of feel bad about it. So it's harder for me to be an iconoclast or, you know, a critic now than it used to be, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, I'm more talking about the perception amongst comedians that everything is stupid, every person is an idiot, and everything that everyone does is, deserves to be made fun of.
Yeah, I don't honestly have that.
I think you've grown. I haven't.
I would observe though that the kind of comedy that Jerry has always done is more, you know, they call you, what do they call it? Observational comedy. You know that.
Yeah, I've always hated that term actually. Everything everybody talks about is based on something they've observed. Are there comedians that do things and they talk about things that they have not observed?
I don't describe Jerry as observational. I mean, when I see Jerry's show, and I've seen you live even within the last couple of years, he's a very gentle comedian. And it's just this beautiful rhythm that flows and flows and flows and does all the things that other comedians have to pace the stage and yell and say the fuck and say everything. You know, it accomplishes all those things that other comedians get in different ways.
But Steve, that reminds me to think about your beginnings during a time when a lot of the comedy was angry and political. George Carlin, Richard Pryor, you were the cheerful, clean cut guy, you know, and your comedy wasn't hostile. It was absurd and funny in a serious time. Were you doing that intentionally?
Yes, but that came as a reaction to the Vietnam War and the love revolution, that there was so much anger. Every comedian did politics, politics, politics. And I just had this feeling once about 1971. I thought, things are going to change. And I cut my hair and I shaved my beard and I put on a suit rather than my hippie clothes. And I became like an accountant. I think the nation was just kind of ready for something a little goofy.
But the amazing thing about what you did, it was an unbelievable act of self-design that you could see yourself in this other persona. And you even knew this. I don't know how you knew that suit, that the suit would work the way it did. Just everything. It was like a pure invention of yourself. But it was an unbelievable piece of self-design.
So I've heard one of the things that Lorne Michaels likes to say about comedy is that it's polite hostility, which maybe that's a Canadian take, but polite mm-hmm. hostility. Kind of a corollary to that, there's an old line that and the average comedian is three parts funny and one part Ethel Merman. But neither of you seems to me to have that Ethel Merman piece of it. Neither of you seems to have that needy, you know, that needy, angry, hostile thing. How are you so well adjusted and so successful at the same time?
Oh, I think the neediness is really not an ingredient at all. I mean, some people have it, some people don't. But the aggression and the hostility, or maybe a better word might be irritability, is an essential ingredient. If you're not easily irritated, I think it's hard to be funny. There is a certain anger in it that makes us laugh because we all have it, but the comedian gives it a candy shell.
You're right. It, for me, in this sense, is that now when I work with Marty, that's where my hostility goes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we get mad at each other in a very slight, subtle way. We get irritated with each other on stage, you know, backstage, right. We're best friends in the world.
And audiences really, they feel that that kind of release. You're kind of releasing that pressure for them.
I once was backstage with Carl Reiner, and now it's 5 minutes before he's going to go on. I said, what are you going to do? Run by some of the jokes. He said, I have no idea. And I said, what do you mean you have no idea? How can you go on with no idea? He says, I just go out and I say what they're thinking.
Wow. Now, Del Close, the improv guru from Second City, apparently said on his deathbed, he was tired of being the funniest guy in the room. So I wonder for you two, is it a burden, being these professionally very funny guys? Do people always expect you to make toasts at weddings? And I mean, can you live a normal life without people expecting you to be cracking them up all the time?
I don't really care about what people expect. I just like to be funny for the fun of it. But I find it difficult when I'm in normal situations to be funny.
It was very hard for me when I first started doing my big act because it was so extreme. And people would think I was that. And I couldn't be that anywhere but on stage. So people were, always disappointed. I had a hair cutter. A young woman, she's like 25, and she would cut my hair. And she told me once, she didn't really know much about me. And she told me once that people would say, you cut Steve Martin's hair? Is it so funny? And she goes, no.
I'm just going to ask you one more question, and then we'll go. You know, comedians... As you know, I mean, maybe more political comedians than you two, but they tend to look at the news through a special lens. You know, is this news story good for comedy? Obviously, Trump is better for comedy than Obama was. But what about this weird moment that we're in now? I mean, what about the pandemic? I mean, here we are talking about comedy in these little boxes on screens. We have no idea if anybody has been laughing. I assume they have. But what do you two make of what we're all going through right now and how it's, what effect it's going to have on this business?
No, it's not going to affect it at all. I mean, when we can come back, we'll come back and people will make jokes about it. And that'll probably be a huge catharsis, I think, for people to be able to laugh at something being in the past.
I don't do political comedy. I can't stand the idea of saying a joke. We've had this happen in our show. You do a political joke and then somebody goes, yay, and then somebody goes, boo, and then suddenly the audience is not tuning anymore.
No, my friend Jim Downey and also Seth Meyer like to talk. There's this term that they use that I think is great called clapter, which is the audience response when they're not laughing. You know, it's not the combustive kind of involuntary laugh, but it's a kind of a, we approve. Yes, I agree with that sentiment.
Yeah,
and that's,
yes.
I'm sure that's not really what you want as a comedian, right?
Well, it's okay, but it's not where the money is.
Jerry Seinfeld's new book is called Is This Anything? And Steve Martin is co-author of A Wealth of Pigeons with New Yorker cartoonist Harry Bliss. They appeared at the New Yorker Festival with editor Susan Morrison.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.